Money FM 89.3, best of weekends.
Here on Money FM, Glenn Van Zutphen and Neil Humphreys also with you for another couple of hours here. Well, we've talked a little bit about the past here. Let's talk about the future right now. Joining us on the line is Dr. Parag Khanna, author of Move, How Mass Migration Will Reshape the World and What It Means for You. If that is not a title of a book, Parag, I don't know what is. Great to have you with us this morning on Money FM.
It's certainly a long enough title. Great to see you again, Glenn. How's it going?
Very good. Now, I've had the good fortune to hear you talk about your book just this week at the 1880 Club. And it is a very, I think, thought-provoking, provocative book. It comes following two other books that you've done, one in 2016, Connectivity, Mapping the Future of Global Civilizations, and 2019, The Future is Asian, which we had you on the show for, The Global Order in the 21st Century. So as we look at this latest book, how does this flow from your previous two? And then we'll talk more specifically about what's in the book.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the stream of consciousness or the arc of the narrative, this is definitely, in a way, a logical continuation of Connectography, which was about global infrastructure and connectivity, and the Asia book, which, among other things, was about demographics and Asia being representing the majority of the human population. So let's put those two together. You have a world of ever-expanding connectivity networks, physical and digital, and you have a world population is primarily Asian. And therefore, I'm answering the question, what is the human species going to do with all of this connectivity in the decades ahead? And primarily, it's going to be Asians, because the further in the future you look, the more the world is Asian demographically. Mm. So, I mean, let me just stop right there. But one last point is that basically, it's a book about geography, but not just rocks and geology and oceans, but rather human geography, which is us. There are 8 billion people in the world. There will probably never be more than 9 billion people in the world, which is a significantly lower estimate than what we've had over the last 10 or 15 years. But because of the baby busts that the world has been experiencing, from the global financial crisis through COVID, of course, and in any case, rich countries, whether it's Singapore or Canada or America, very low fertility, we live in a world in which actually we're going to start to view this finite stock of human beings as a talent pool, and there will be a global war for talent to recruit young people into countries. And Singapore is going to be obviously front and center in that talent war.
I find this subject absolutely fascinating, Parag. I really do. And now look, you're talking more about an economic perspective there, but the conventional wisdom says that as climate change becomes a more pressing concern with the younger generations, the rich will flock to certain safer countries and the low-lying countries will pay as a consequence. So, you know, Singapore is relatively safe, so the rich will flood here and people will leave Australia and other countries. I mean, how do you see that playing out? Do you see it in such pessimistic terms?
Well, so I have 4 scenarios in the book, and 3 of them are rather pessimistic, indeed, dire, you might even say, in terms of the reorganization of our human geography and whether it proceeds in a sustainable and in a utilitarian way, one that benefits the majority of the world's population. And again, 3 of the scenarios don't look so good. One of them does. I call it Northern Lights. It doesn't really mean that everyone needs to migrate to Canada and Russia and the rest of us will perish. It's really about whether or not, if you take all of the climate forecasts that show us what geographies will be livable, can we move enough people there so that the maximum number of human beings survive the constant climate or cascading climate disruptions that we're facing? And the answer is we can do it. You know, we can do it logistically very easily. Again, going back to connectivity, right, and infrastructure. You can put people on planes. You can put them on trains. You can put them on ferry boats. You can move them to air-conditioned cities. You can build nomadic enclaves and centers across Siberia. We have the technology not only today but yesterday to save the human species. But of course, there's a lot of intervening political variables to get that right, which is why I'm overall relatively pessimistic, unless we actually have this collective psychological realization that there really aren't that many human beings in the world. And this is the part that's the real punch in the face. We have actually anyone of a certain age, above the age of 40, let's say, has grown up thinking that the world population is this runaway train that's going to be 15 billion people, and we're actually heading towards a Malthusian crisis of overpopulation. No such thing is true. Literally 9 billion human beings is a very small number of human beings, right? There are far less human beings than there are of most other species on the planet Earth, other than the ones that we have killed off. Right. You know, so there's not as many pandas, right, as there are humans.
But
right?
Right, just jump in there. Sorry, just jump in there. But those other species are not doing the harm to the planet that humans are they? They're not devouring the natural resources like humans are.
Right. And it's a good thing that our population numbers are stabilizing and are actually going to decline by organic means, because you're going to have the sort of mortality gradually of the baby boomers, and you have children having very few children. So the world population will stabilize and it will even decline. The question is, does it drop back down to 7 or 8 billion, or does it collapse due to, again, spiraling out of control climate change or further pandemics to 3 or 4 billion people, which would not be a pretty picture.
Parag, let's unpack that just a little bit, because that might be a surprising concept to our listeners, our Facebook Live friends. And we're talking with Dr. Parag Khanna, author of Move, How Mass Migration Will Reshape the World and What It Means for You. Let's discuss Gen Alpha, the next generation right. coming up, and their reproductive habits, or what they might be, according to some demographers, including yourself. But let's unpack that a little bit, and why you say the peak population of the planet may only be 9 billion versus 15 or 16.
Sure. And apologies to those on Facebook Live. I will wake up for Glenn, but I will not comb my hair for Glenn. So,
you look great, Mike. You look great. So let's, yeah, no worries.
So Gen Z, which is today's, you know, pre-tweens, tweens, teenagers, is the largest single generation of human beings that our species has ever produced. There's about 1.9 billion members of Gen Z. So if you have a Gen Z kid, they're really special, right? But guess what? Gen Alpha, if you have a little baby, a toddler, Gen Alpha will be smaller. Gen Alpha isn't yet complete. Gen Alpha will complete in the year 2025. But when we reconvene, Glenn, in January 2026, we will know matter-of-factly that the number of Gen Alpha kids on Earth is smaller than Gen Z. And that is the seminal kind of moment in a way. But it's already happening. We already know that that's what's going to happen. And so the fact of the matter is that it's the result of the fact that both millennials and Gen Z have a reduced proclivity for having children.
Why is that, Parag?
Everything, right. So it's economic stress. So the financial crisis hit in the 2007-2008, just as many millennials were considering having children or maybe having another child. But the economic stress was very severe at the time. And so people pushed off having children. Then within a decade, boom, you have COVID, which is a baby bust that is significantly more severe than even the financial crisis was. And on top of all of this, at the same time, you have climate change. And when you ask in surveys all over the world of young people of childbearing age and young families, they're asked, why don't you want to have children? And the answer is either economics, it's just too expensive, or it's climate. And increasingly, climate is the dominant reason, but it's both at the same time. So literally, the young generation around the world carries this climate guilt that having a child equates to additional damage to the planet.
That is a fascinating scenario, yeah. Parag. And let's use, because I think this is so interesting to me, let's use Singapore as a microcosm for the world after you've answered your phone.
Hello.
I will not be answering.
That's Dan,
your phone,
the producer,
sorry.
Calling you. Let's use.
Did I say something offensive? I don't work for Samsung.
No, it's the government.
don't call
it's
me.
The Singapore government. No, let's use Singapore as a microcosm, because I think it encapsulates everything you're talking about. Low fertility, younger generation having fewer babies. So what happens? Singapore has no choice but to import. So it imports larger numbers of foreigners. Now, there are projections of 6, 7, even 10 million has been mooted as a possibility for Singapore, because it's relatively climate stable with lots of climate measures in place, lots of switches towards, you know, green energies and so on and so on. However, I'm thinking about it from a political standpoint and how this could be replicated around the world. You could have massive uncertainty, massive political tensions if your population, if your native population is outnumbered by foreigners. Imagine if you have a scenario where 8 million people live in Singapore and 5 million of them are foreigners. I'm projecting as an example to follow your theory. What could that do, or what could potentially happen for Singapore and therefore the rest of the world?
Right. Well, there's only one country in the world with such a ludicrously lopsided demographic ratio. So Qatar is very small, but equivalent to Singapore would be the United Arab Emirates, right next door, where the indigenous population is only 1/10 of the total, population of the country. However, what they've started to do is to give ever more citizenship to Arab peoples of different nationalities, because the UAE is a fairly powerful passport. And they're doing that, by the way, no accident, to copy Singapore, because, of course, Singapore gives citizenship to many foreigners from across the world. And so when you say the future potential ratio of Singaporeans, of, you know, natives, locals to foreigners, how do you define that? Because, again, a lot of people who are Singaporean were not born here. So it's actually far more subtle and complicated than what you're describing. And in terms of, you know, again, there's nothing that the Singapore government is not unique in that it, alongside the French government and the Russian government and many governments, have tried to promote fertility, a voucher for a date night, really a day off for Valentine's Day.
The baby bonus, et cetera.
Baby bonus. It does not work. I've looked at every possible scheme in the world. It doesn't work, right? And, China has gone from the one-child policy to the two-child policy to the three-child policy, but no one took them up on the two-child policy, let alone the three-child policy. So let's face it, this is reality as it is. Let's accept it. And let's actually embrace the idea that we need to do a better job with promoting well-being for those human beings that exist in the world, and make them us, make them part of our societies for the betterment of the human condition, rather than saying, let's cripple our own economy and have really low immigration, and in the hopes that our own quote-unquote native people will have more children that they're never going to have. That's not what I call pragmatism. It's my job to work with governments all over the world to get them to attain the possible, not to cling to utopian and naive dreams.
Fascinating.
Yeah, we're talking with Parag Khanna, author of Move, How Mass Migration Will Reshape the World and What It Means for You. He is also the founder and managing partner of Future Map. Parag, you have talked about the future of the world is going to be Asian youth, and also the future of successful countries will be those who accept high-skilled foreign talent, and the downfall for some countries will be the ones that don't accept that talent. That's a lot to unpack, but tell us your thoughts on those two issues.
And the losers are also those who are literally losing their own talent,
right?
Not only not attracting, from the global pool, but where you see young people leaving a country, it means that they are the best signal. You don't need a political risk analyst from New York to tell you that Bulgaria is in trouble, because the fact is, all you have to do is look at the outflow of young Bulgarians. And what I did was I looked at conscription policies, among other measures around the world, every country that has military conscription, including Singapore. And I said, what do young people do when they reach conscription age? And what I found is that from Korea to Turkey to Russia, everywhere, the rite of passage for any young male is to get out. Like, pay whatever bribe you can. And of course, it's one of the great virtues of Singapore, not only that NS is mandatory and instituted as such, but that it's also desired. People feel that they come out a better person, as a result, and it strengthens social solidarity, which is incredibly important compared to those countries that lack that common, that social cohesion. So anyway, bottom line, though, if I could put, a hammer on this one point, the fact is that if a country is gaining young people, it's going to thrive in the future, barring climate change or other unforeseen, volatility. If a country is losing its young people, it's absolutely finished. Don't invest there. And that's it. That's your layman's guide to, investing in the 21st century and determining the success or failure of societies in the 21st century. But I'm pleased to report that if you look at the last 2 years during COVID, when allegedly we were all locked down, a lot of young people did a lot of moving, because instead of one country having a nomad visa program, for which Estonia was only famous in sort of cult circles, today 75 countries have nomad visa programs. 75 countries woke up during COVID and said, oh my God, we don't have business travelers, tourists, students,
What does that visa mean exactly? What is a nomad visa for those who don't know?
Well, so it isn't always the same, but roughly speaking, it's just come and show up. You'll get a visa on arrival. Stay as long as you like. Please don't commit a crime. Use our Wi-Fi, you know, rent our Airbnbs, stay in our cafes, just be in our country and spend money, because otherwise we'll go bankrupt. Hmm. And there's a wide spectrum of offerings within such programs. And again, 75, 80, soon 100, probably soon the whole world will wake up and realize it's better to have people than not to have people. Collecting people is collecting power. And it's actually one of the oldest principles of geopolitics going back to the 19th century. Hmm. But it's something that we forgot in an era of demographic abundance, which is what the 20th century was. But the 21st century is going to be an era of demographic scarcity, where we're actually fighting over people. So the fact that Singapore happens to be an incredibly attractive place is something to play on and not an opportunity to let slip by.
That's the part I'm fascinated by, this demographic scarcity, as you mentioned. So in theory, you know, I lived in Australia for a while, and there were rust belt towns, you know, post-industrial decay, former gold mining towns that had been completely abandoned. America the same, post-industrial decay. Sure. You see it across parts of Northern Europe, the UK, the north of England, mass exodus there. Do you foresee long term, I'm just curious, where you could almost have rust belt countries, entire regions that are almost empty of people? Is that a possibility in the long term?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I scoured far and wide in the kind of literature, whether it's even climate change literature or even the literature around kind of the economic evolution of countries. And no one was willing to say or to call these places, you really, really put your finger on something so important, truly. I call them vacant states.
Yep.
And I actually foresee that entire swaths of the planet will be physically vacated because they're no longer habitable. The country of Yemen will have no water, and that's 25 or 30 million people who will literally either die or leave Yemen. That's it. You have two choices. You can't live without water, as we know. You know, Turkmenistan, you know, other parts of Africa. So I call these places vacant states, and they'll no longer meet the legal definition of a state. So I have to actually call them something else, because the definition of a state in international law is that you have a permanent resident population and your borders are recognized by your neighbors in the international community. So the places still have a role. We might actually dump nuclear waste in those places. We may just go and send in tractors and mine their soil and sediment for minerals. The geography will be useful, but they will not be livable or inhabitable for human beings. And that's actually happening today.
Yeah.
And I was kind of shocked in my research that not enough people are just calling it what it is. But this is where, you know, kind of my work is in geography, and this is fundamentally a geographical question, not one of whether or not it's politically palatable to say this or not to say this.
I've seen it in towns across Australia.
It's amazing.
And they say they'll come back, they'll come back. And how?
They will never come back. Yeah. There are places, though, by the way. I mean, you know, there's happy stories out there. If you look at Detroit, Michigan, now it was deindustrialized through the 2000s because of economic outsourcing and globalization and, you know, wages not keeping pace and so forth. But because Michigan is a climate oasis, whereas the parts of Australia that are desertifying are not, you can imagine Michigan in particular, you know, having a thriving population 10, 15, 20 years from now, and having being home to a whole host of new industries. And you can already see the signals of that today. So there's actually these yo-yo effects. People leave a place when it collapses economically, but return to a place because it happens to have a thriving climate. And that's the kind of chaos, if you will, that I'm foreseeing in terms of our demographic movement. So it's very nice if you live in an island of stability. And one of the things that we noticed during COVID is, what were the best places to be during COVID around the world? You know, Taiwan, New Zealand, Singapore, Iceland, Malta. What do we have in all in common? Well, we are islands who can close ourselves off, and we're wealthy and we're well-governed. So the best place to be in times of stress is island nations that are well-governed and wealthy.
There you go. So
consider yourselves lucky.
Brilliant. Parag, this is a great conversation.
Yeah.
We do have to leave it there. Dr. Parag Khanna, who is the managing partner and founder of FutureMap, also the author of Move, How Mass Migration Will Reshape the World and What It Means to You. Parag, if you want to put any links in the Facebook Live chat for your book and your websites and things, please do that. I'm sure our listeners would love to see that. In the meantime, thanks for being with us. Hope to have you on again.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at MoneyFM893.sg or download our audio app.
That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.